A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He was in a Swiss supermarket recently, just passing through for a night, and noticed something off. The dairy aisle was cheap, abundant, almost absurdly so. Meanwhile, back home in Israel, basic milk costs more than it does in Zurich, a country with 40% higher GDP per capita. And that observation, that inversion, is the puzzle. Why are necessities luxury priced in Israel while Switzerland treats cheese like a loss leader? Is any developed economy actually solving the cost of living crisis, or are they just masking it in different ways? There's a lot to unpack here.
That supermarket trip got us thinking. What does the data actually say about how different countries price their necessities? Let's start with the numbers. The OECD publishes two metrics that matter here. The first is comparative price levels, or CPL. That's the actual price of a basket of goods and services across countries, with the OECD average set at 100. The second is purchasing power parity adjusted disposable income, which is what people can actually buy with what they earn. The distinction matters because a country can look rich on GDP per capita and still leave its median worker unable to afford milk.
Which is Israel's entire story in one sentence.
So let's anchor this in the most recent data. The OECD released its 2024 comparative price levels dataset in March of 2025. OECD average is 100. Israel's overall CPL came in at 1018. The US at 112 fwt. Switzerland at 145, the highest in the OECD. Japan at 98, actually below the average.
On the headline number, Switzerland is the most expensive country in the developed world, and Israel is above average but not catastrophic. That doesn't match the lived experience at all.
Because the aggregate hides everything. The composition of prices, what's expensive and what's cheap within a country, that's the real story. And this is where I want to introduce something I'm calling the necessity premium. It's the ratio of food and housing prices to the overall CPL. If your food prices are way above your general price level, you're taxing necessities.
Switzerland could be 145 overall, but have food at 110, while Israel is 118 overall, but food at 125. The aggregate makes Switzerland look worse, but the Swiss shopper buying dinner is having a better time than the Israeli shopper.
That's precisely the pattern, and it gets sharper when you zoom in on specific categories. Israeli food prices sit at 125% of the OECD average, but dairy specifically, milk, cheese, yogurt, comes in at 140% of the OECD average. That's despite government price controls on raw milk that have been in place since the 2014 dairy reform.
Wait, dairy is the most controlled food category in Israel, and it's also the most expensive relative to other countries. That's not what price controls are supposed to do.
This is the first big misconception to bust. Price controls don't automatically lower prices. In Israel's dairy market, they created a floor, not a ceiling. Here's how the mechanism works. The Dairy Council regulates raw milk production through a quota system. Farmers are guaranteed a minimum price for raw milk. That price is set through negotiations between the government, the dairy producers, and the farmers, and it's consistently above what you'd get in a competitive market. The Bank of Israel put out a report on this in 2023 that found the price controls reduced price dispersion across stores, meaning milk costs roughly the same everywhere, but they didn't lower the average price. The controlled price became the floor, and everything else floated above it.
The government says milk shall not exceed this price, but the regulated price is already high because of the production quotas, and then anything not covered by the control, yogurt, cream, specialty cheeses, has no ceiling at all. You get a two-tier market where the cheap stuff is expensive, and the premium stuff is even more expensive.
That's the 2014 five-shekel yogurt law in a nutshell. After the 2011 social protests, hundreds of thousands of Israelis in the streets over the cost of living, the government introduced price controls on a basket of basic dairy products. White cheese, basic milk, that kind of thing. The law was sold as making yogurt cost 5 shekels, but the controls only covered a narrow set of items. So what happened? The controlled items immediately rose to the cap, because why would anyone sell below the legal maximum if the production cost is already near it? And the uncontrolled items, flavored yogurt, cream cheese, hard cheeses, their prices kept climbing because now producers had to make their margin somewhere.
Like squeezing a balloon. You cap one end, the other end bulges.
The balloon analogy is actually generous, because squeezing a balloon doesn't raise the pressure at the squeezed end, it just redistributes it. Here, the cap became the new minimum. So you walk into an Israeli supermarket, and the basic white cheese is at the regulated maximum, which is already high by international standards. And the Greek yogurt next to it is even more expensive because that's where the margin lives.
Let's put actual numbers on this. You mentioned specific prices in the prompt. What does a liter of milk actually cost?
In Tel Aviv, a liter of milk runs about 7.5 shekels. That's roughly $2.05. In Zurich, the same liter costs about 1 Swiss franc 30, which is about $1.45. Switzerland has 40% higher GDP per capita, and their milk is 30% cheaper.
The Swiss dairy aisle. What Daniel walked into and found almost surreal. That's not an accident. That's engineered.
It's a deliberate retail strategy, and it's worth understanding because it's the mirror image of Israel's approach. Switzerland has a retail duopoly. Migros and Coop control something like 70% of the grocery market. They use dairy as a loss leader. Milk, cheese, basic yogurt, these are priced at or below cost to drive foot traffic. Once you're in the store buying your cheap milk, you also pick up the things where margins are 40 to 60%. High-end pens, electronics, specialty foods, wine. The Swiss Federal Statistical Office's 2024 Household Expenditure Survey shows this pattern clearly. The basket of necessities is cheap. The basket of luxuries is expensive.
Switzerland runs a regressive subsidy on necessities. Everyone gets cheap milk regardless of income, which means wealthy households get more absolute benefit because they consume more, and a progressive tax on luxuries because rich people buy more high-end pens. Israel runs the opposite. Expensive necessities are a regressive tax. They hit low-income households hardest because food and housing consume a larger share of their budget.
That's the structural inversion. And the Swiss agricultural subsidy system reinforces it. Switzerland spends about 3.5 billion Swiss francs annually on agricultural subsidies, which works out to roughly 20% of farm income. That keeps domestic production high and prices low at the retail level, even before the duopoly's loss leader strategy kicks in. Israel's agricultural subsidies exist, but they're structured differently. They protect producer incomes through quotas and price floors rather than subsidizing consumer prices directly.
The Swiss government pays farmers to produce, and the retail duopoly competes on necessities to get people in the door. The Israeli government protects farmers by guaranteeing high prices, and the retail market is concentrated enough. Shufersal and Rami Levy have about 60% of the market, that there's no competitive pressure to use basics as loss leaders.
The concentration numbers are actually worse than they sound because geographic segmentation means many neighborhoods effectively have one chain. But let me pull back to the macro picture because Israel's food prices don't exist in isolation. The real cost of living crisis is a housing plus food crisis.
The dual economy problem.
Israel has what economists call a dual economy. The high-tech sector employs about 15% of the workforce but generates roughly 50% of exports. Those salaries, we're talking median tech wages around 25,000 to 30,000 shekels a month, pull up the national average. But the bottom 50% of earners are mostly in services, retail, education, and they're facing housing costs that have risen 60% since 2019, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics 2025 report. Median wages over the same period rose 18%, so housing costs grew more than 3 times faster than paychecks.
That's the squeeze in one statistic. Your rent goes up 60%, your salary goes up 18%, and your milk is more expensive than Switzerland's.
This is where the purchasing power parity data gets brutal. Israel's GDP per capita is at the OECD average, respectable, developed economy territory. but the median wage, about 12,000 shekels a month in 2024, is only 60% of the OECD median when you adjust for purchasing power. The OECD employment outlook for 2025 lays this out. Israel has high output per worker, but that output is concentrated in a small slice of the workforce. The median Israeli worker produces less, earns less, and then pays more for basics.
The Israel paradox: high GDP per capita, low living standards for the median worker, is really a distribution story. The average is pulled up by the top quartile, and the median is dragged down by everything underneath.
Inflation has made this worse. Let me give you the cumulative picture since 2021. Food prices in Israel rose about 12% cumulatively. Rents in Tel Aviv rose 18%. The Bank of Israel calculated in their 2025 financial stability report that a typical household's disposable income for non-essentials, what's left after housing and food, has shrunk by 22% in real terms.
A family that had 1,000 shekels a month for everything beyond rent and groceries now has 780. That's a felt loss, even if the number on the paycheck went up.
This brings us to the second big question from the prompt. Is any developed economy bucking the inflation trend? The answer is yes, but bucking the trend doesn't always mean what people think it means.
Let's hear the Japan story, because I know you've been digging into this.
Japan is the standout on headline inflation. Core inflation in 2024 was 1.8%, compared to the OECD average of 4.2%. That's remarkably low. But the mechanism behind it is 30 years of deflationary psychology. Japanese consumers and businesses have spent decades expecting prices to stay flat or fall. That suppresses demand, which suppresses price increases, which reinforces the expectation. It's a self-fulfilling cycle.
The flip side is wage stagnation.
Nominal wage growth in Japan has been below 1% for 25 years. The Ministry of Internal Affairs data for 2025 shows wages grew 0.7% in 2024. So yes, prices are stable. But incomes aren't growing either. The OECD, Economic Survey of Japan from 2024, is blunt about this. Japan's low inflation is a symptom of structural stagnation, not brilliant economic management. Real wages have been flat for decades. Things aren't getting more expensive, but they're not getting more affordable either, because affordability is a ratio of prices to income.
Japan is cheap, in a way that doesn't help the median worker. The prices are low, but the paychecks are lower than they should be. It's stability without growth.
Then there's the U.S. comparison, which is almost the inverse. U.S. inflation in 2024 was 3.5%, higher than Israel's 3.8, actually quite similar on the headline. But U.S. wage growth over the same period was 4.2%. Real wages grew. Prices went up, but paychecks went up faster.
The American consumer felt inflation, but their purchasing power actually improved. The Israeli consumer felt similar inflation, but wage growth was only 2.1%. Real wages fell. Same inflation story, opposite outcome for the household budget.
That's the critical distinction. Headline inflation numbers dominate the news, but what matters for living standards is the gap between price growth and wage growth. The U.S. had a positive gap. Israel had a negative gap. Japan had low everything. Low inflation, low wage growth. So the gap was roughly zero, but from a baseline of decades of stagnation.
You mentioned their food inflation was the lowest in the OECD.
Switzerland's overall inflation in 2024 was 1.4%. Their food inflation specifically was 0.8%, the lowest in the entire OECD, according to the OECD Economic Outlook from May 2025. This is the Switzerland exception in a different sense. They're not just low inflation, they're low food inflation in a way that's structurally engineered. The strong Swiss franc imports deflation. When your currency appreciates, imports get cheaper. And the retail duopoly keeps margins thin on essentials while making their profit on luxuries. The result is that the things you have to buy stay cheap, and the things you choose to buy are where the cost lives.
Three very different models. The US model. Let inflation run a bit, but make sure wages outpace it. The Japan model. Suppress inflation through decades of deflationary expectations, but accept wage stagnation as the trade-off. The Swiss model. Use currency strength and retail strategy to make necessities artificially cheap and recoup on luxuries.
Israel doesn't fit any of these. Israel has U.S. level inflation with Japan, level wage growth for the bottom half of earners, plus a Swiss level concentration of retail power but without the lost leader strategy. It's the worst combination.
The concentrated retail power in Israel is an interesting parallel to Switzerland, actually. Both countries have a grocery duopoly. Migros and Coop in Switzerland, Shufersal and Rami Levy in Israel. But the Swiss duopoly competes on basics. The Israeli duopoly doesn't have to, because the price controls create a floor that eliminates price competition on the controlled items, and the geographic segmentation means many consumers don't have realistic alternatives.
The Bank of Israel has been saying this for years. Their 2023 report on the food market found that concentration isn't just about market share, it's about the structure of competition. When price controls set a floor, the competitive dynamic shifts from who can sell milk cheapest to who can sell milk at the cap and make up margin elsewhere. The competition moves to the uncontrolled items, where there's no ceiling and prices drift up.
The well-intentioned 2014 reform. Let's cap basic dairy so poor families can afford yogurt. Actually created a market where basic dairy is expensive by international standards and premium dairy is even worse. The people it was supposed to help are paying more for the controlled items than Swiss consumers pay for uncontrolled ones.
This connects to a broader point about how governments are approaching the cost of living crisis globally. There are roughly three strategies in play across the OECD. One is monetary. Central banks raising rates to cool demand, which the U.S. Fed and the European Central Bank have done aggressively. Two is fiscal. Direct transfers to households, tax cuts on essentials, rent controls. Three is regulatory. Price controls, competition policy, breaking up monopolies.
Israel has tried all three, and the results are...
Israel's central bank raised rates from 0.1% in early 2022 to 4.75% by mid-2023, which did cool housing demand but also made mortgages more expensive, so it hurt the same people it was supposed to help. The government has done periodic direct transfers. The 2023 cost of living payment was a few hundred shekels per household, but those are one-offs that don't change the structural price level. And the regulatory approach, as we've seen with dairy, created floors rather than ceilings.
What about countries that are actually trying something different? Is anyone innovating on this?
Spain introduced a VAT cut on basic foods in 2023, olive oil, bread, milk, eggs, dropping the rate from 4% to zero. That's a direct price reduction that doesn't distort producer incentives the way price controls do. The producer still gets the market price, the government just takes less tax. Early data from Spain's National Statistics Institute suggests it shaved about 1.5 percentage points off food inflation. It's not transformative, but it's targeted and doesn't create the floor problem.
South Korea has been experimenting with something more aggressive on housing, right?
South Korea's housing crisis makes Israel's look tame. Seoul apartment prices rose something like 50% between 2019 and 2022. The government responded with a massive public housing construction program and tighter lending rules. But the more interesting intervention was on food. They've been using a public online platform to sell basic foods at near wholesale prices, effectively creating a government-run competitor to the retail chains. It's too early to say if it's working at scale, but it's a structural attempt to inject price competition rather than just capping prices.
That's the Swiss lost leader strategy, but implemented by the state instead of a duopoly. Use cheap basics to draw people in.
It raises the question of whether Israel could do something similar. The agricultural quotas and the Dairy Council's price-setting power are deeply entrenched. They've survived multiple reform attempts. But the Swiss model shows that making necessities cheap isn't impossible. It just requires either a competitive retail market that treats basics as loss leaders or a state mechanism that achieves the same effect.
Let me pull us to the framework that I think ties this all together. You mentioned the necessity ratio earlier. Food plus housing as a percentage of median disposable income. That's the number that actually captures whether a country is affordable to live in. What do those ratios look like across the countries we've been discussing?
The OECD Better Life Index for 2025 gives us this. The OECD average for the necessity ratio, that's food plus housing costs divided by median disposable income, is 0.38. So the median household in a typical developed economy spends 38% of their after-tax income on food and housing. Switzerland comes in at 0.35, below the average, despite being the most expensive country on headline CPL. The cheap necessities strategy actually works. Israel is at 0.52.
52%. More than half of median income goes to food and housing.
That's the number that explains the feeling Daniel described, leaving Israel and finding everything cheap. It's not that other countries have lower absolute prices on everything. It's that the things you have to buy, the non-negotiable basket, consume a much smaller share of your income elsewhere. In Switzerland, the necessities are cheap and the luxuries are expensive, so your disposable income goes further on the things you can't avoid buying. In Israel, the necessities eat your paycheck before you get to the discretionary stuff. Japan's necessity ratio is around 0.36, similar to Switzerland's, but for different reasons. Japan's housing costs are low, decades of flat or falling land prices outside central Tokyo, and food is cheap because of the deflationary environment. But remember, that comes with wage stagnation. A low necessity ratio is great, but if your denominator, your income, hasn't grown in 25 years, you're treading water.
The US sits somewhere in the middle on the necessity ratio, but the wage growth story makes it feel different.
The US necessity ratio is about 0.39, right at the OECD average. But the wage growth trajectory matters. If your income is growing at 4% and your necessity costs are growing at 3.5%, you're slowly gaining ground. If your income is growing at 2% and your necessity costs are growing at 4%, Israel's situation, you're losing ground every year.
That's the dynamic that makes the cost of living crisis feel acute, even when headline inflation is similar to other countries. It's not just the price level, it's the direction and speed of change relative to income.
Let me give you the cumulative numbers that make this concrete. Between 2021 and the end of 2024, Israel's cumulative consumer price inflation was about 14%. Cumulative wage growth for the median worker was about 8%, so the median worker lost about 6% of their real purchasing power over 3 years. In the US, cumulative inflation was about 16%, but cumulative wage growth for the median worker was about 15%, roughly breaking even. In Switzerland, cumulative inflation was about 7%, and wages grew about 6%, again, roughly even, but from a much lower inflation baseline.
The Israeli worker is uniquely squeezed, not because inflation is uniquely high, it's in line with the developed world, but because wages aren't keeping pace.
This brings us back to the dual economy. The high-tech sector in Israel has seen wage growth that outpaces inflation. Software engineers, data scientists, cybersecurity people, their salaries have grown 15 to 20% over the same period, but they're 15% of the workforce. The other 85% are in sectors where wage growth is sluggish and inflation bites hard. The aggregate statistics hide this bifurcation.
When the government points to GDP growth and average wage growth, they're technically telling the truth. The average is going up. But the median is stagnating or falling in real terms. The high-tech elite pulls the average up. The median worker feels the squeeze.
This is where the cost of living crisis becomes a political crisis. People don't experience the average. They experience their own paycheck and their own supermarket bill. If your salary went up 5% and your grocery bill went up 12%, you don't care that the national average wage grew 8%. You know you're falling behind.
Let me ask you the forward-looking question. The OECD is forecasting global inflation to moderate to about 3.2% for 2026. If that happens, does the structural disparity between countries persist? Or does moderation smooth everything out?
The structural disparity almost certainly persists because it's baked into regulatory and retail structures, not just macroeconomic cycles. Switzerland's cheap necessities aren't a product of low inflation. They're a product of agricultural subsidies and a retail strategy that's been in place for decades. Israel's expensive dairy isn't a product of high inflation. It's a product of quota systems and price floors that predate the recent inflationary episode. Inflation amplifies these structural differences, but it doesn't create them.
Even if global inflation settles back to 2 or 3%, the Israeli shopper will still pay more for milk than the Swiss shopper. The gap might stop widening, but it won't close.
Closing the gap would require structural reform, reforming the dairy quota system, introducing real competition in retail, addressing housing supply constraints. Those are politically difficult and have been stalled for years. The 2011 protests led to some reforms, but the core structures, the dairy council, the agricultural quotas, the concentrated retail market, are still in place.
The housing side is even harder to fix. You can't quickly build enough housing to reverse a 60% price increase, especially in a country with Israel's land constraints and planning bureaucracy.
The Bank of Israel estimated in their 2024 report that Israel needs to build about 70,000 new housing units per year just to keep up with population growth. Actual construction has been around 55,000. That annual deficit accumulates, and it's been accumulating for years. Housing is a supply problem, and supply problems don't resolve quickly.
If I'm a listener trying to make sense of international cost of living comparisons, whether I'm traveling, considering a move, or just trying to understand the news, what should I actually look at? What's the framework?
Don't look at aggregate comparative price levels. They're misleading. Switzerland's CPL is 145, but its necessity ratio is below the OECD average. Israel's CPL is 118, but its necessity ratio is the highest among developed economies. The headline number tells you the wrong story.
Look at the necessity basket, food, housing, transport, as a percentage of median disposable income. That's the real affordability measure.
Within that basket, pay attention to the composition. Are necessities cheap and luxuries expensive, like Switzerland? That's a progressive pricing structure. It protects low-income households. Are necessities expensive and luxuries relatively cheap, like Israel? That's regressive. It squeezes the bottom. Are necessities and luxuries both cheap, like Japan? That's great for current purchasing power, but might signal wage stagnation. Are necessities and luxuries both expensive, but wages are growing faster, like the U.S.? That's inflationary, but not necessarily a crisis for living standards.
The pattern of what's cheap and what's expensive tells you more about a country's economic structure than any inflation statistic. Next time you're in a supermarket abroad, don't just look at the prices. Look at what's cheap and what's expensive. That pattern is the real story.
If you want to put a number on it, the necessity ratio is the metric to calculate. Take the median monthly cost of rent plus utilities plus food for a typical household, divide by median monthly disposable income. If it's above 0.45, that country has a structural affordability problem regardless of what the GDP per capita says. If it's below 0.35, they're doing something right, either through deliberate policy like Switzerland or through structural factors like Japan.
The cost of living crisis is really a distribution crisis. The countries that appear to solve it do so by making trade-offs. Switzerland trades expensive luxuries for cheap necessities. Japan trades wage growth for price stability. The US trades higher inflation for higher wage growth. There's no free lunch, just different patterns of who pays and how.
Israel's pattern is the one where the median worker pays the most and gets the least in return. That's not a macroeconomic inevitability. It's a set of policy choices about agricultural quotas, retail competition, housing supply, and wage bargaining that have accumulated over decades.
The Swiss dairy aisle isn't cheap by accident, and the Israeli dairy aisle isn't expensive by accident either. Both are the visible end of a long chain of policy decisions.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, a Tasmanian naturalist recorded that certain jellyfish species can revert from their adult medusa stage back to their polyp stage, essentially aging backwards, which means if you convert their life cycle to human terms, it's as if a butterfly could decide to become a caterpillar again, and then a butterfly again, indefinitely.
Jellyfish are just opting out of mortality.
That's unsettling.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for the fact and the production. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps people find the show. We're at myweirdprompts.com for past episodes and transcripts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before, the host digging
the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.